Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a monthly program I've been producing here on KZYX and Z for 8 years. Normally, the program is live and hosted by local high school students. Due to the general confusion created by the fires, we were unable to organize a new show for today. Instead, we will listen to two interviews from our archives. First, a student from Willits Charter School, Sarah Schlauder, interviewed Linda Knoll in November 2003. Sarah and Linda are both local Native Americans, and the topic is growing up Native in Mendocino County. Then we will hear an interview with Native American activist John Trudell, conducted by Patty Martin in May 2006. Here is Sarah Schlauder interviewing Linda Knoll.
Hello, I'm Sarah Schlauder, a student at the Willits Charter School. My family is Pomo. I'm going to interview Linda Knoll, a Koyong Kaui, who grew up in Willits. Linda is a well-known poet. The subject of the show is about growing up Native in Mendocino County. Do you feel there's a difference between growing up Native and growing up European in Mendocino County?
Yes, I do feel there is a difference. I've lived it, and it's interesting because I've been thinking about, you know, this interview, and as I was driving up from work, I was thinking about incidents, and of course everybody has incidents. But as I was coming down Commercial Street, I was thinking about, it's not just the incidents, it's this underlying ugly thing that is always there that surfaces in times of defense or, adversarial situations. And I was thinking about a situation in particular, to grab my thought here for a moment, in particular about an incident. I believe I was in the fourth grade over at Bechtel Grove School, and I had a friend, and I can remember the friend, and I can remember her face and her name and her family and things, and I can't remember. We were walking home from school and something happened, and anyway, we ended up getting in some kind of altercation, this mouthing at each other. And of course, just like that, what came out of her mouth was like, okay, well, okay, Blackie, you're just a Blackie anyway, kind of thing. And that's what I mean by the underlying ugly thing that is always there that makes a difference.
Where do you feel that comes from or stems from?
Well, I think it's real old. I think it's as old as America, with the, you know, premise that the Native peoples were lesser and were ignorant or stupid or savage or what other demeaning word you want to use. And I think it's just as true in California history. It's there in the history, even though you may not hear about it, but it certainly doesn't mean it's not true or it doesn't happen just because you don't hear about it. So I think it's old, it's historical, it's part of what America's made on, or made of, built on.
What is your tribal affiliation?
I'm Koyong Kaui, and in our language, I would say I'm Koyong Kaui Maidu. And other people know my people as Konkau, because that's how we're listed with the government, because I'm sure whoever was going around taking the tally and documenting us wasn't going to bother with saying Koyong Kaui, so they said, we'll just call him Konkau. And in our language, that means people of the meadow. And why we would say Maidu is we would say Maidu if we saw anybody else of Native origin, just meaning people, we're people and other people like us. Like, you know, if my mom saw another Indian person, regardless of what tribe they were, because she probably wouldn't know what tribe they were, she would just say, oh, isn't that a Maidu? Meaning, isn't that another Indian person? So I'm Koyong Kaui Maidu to make the story long. It's from over in the Gold Country, up in Plumas in Butte County, some in Yuba County. And as with many Native people, you know, they were in the high country in the good months when they could be, and then they came to the lower valleys in the winter.
What was your family history?
Oh, that's so interesting that you would ask that at this point, because I've recently been doing a lot of digging about my family history, because for a long time, my mother and I always thought that there wasn't much documentation about our family other than through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We came from the high country in Plumas County. My mother was born and raised there. Her mother was born there outside of Quincy. My grandfather on my mother's side was a headman out of Belden, which is kind of like up along the Feather River. And then my father was born over near Feathers Falls and grew up in Yuba County or around a town called Challenge, because there's all those little gold mining towns up there which aren't hardly in existence anymore. There's just usually a little store, not even a gas station anymore. My father eventually went to work in the woods and became a cat skidder who skidded roads in the logging. And he and several other families came over here because the logging, they were destroying the redwood forests over here. And to them, through their eyes, it was opportunity for work and to rise out of poverty. And so he and several other families came over here to work in various, mostly logging. But we were the only ones that really stayed. Everybody else came back. And so he came into the logging industry and came over here, and myself and my younger brother of 8 children were born here in Willits. And he eventually left logging and worked for the city of Willits.
Have you always gone to school through Willits and Willits?
Yes, I have. It's interesting. It's real interesting because I haven't lived in Willits for about 10 or 11 years, and it's interesting when I come to town sometimes and see people that I went to school with. And as I get older, it's even more interesting.
Did you like going to school in Willits?
You know, I had, like I said, I had some incidents, and at the time I didn't really realize what they were, other than that I thought that, you know, some of the teachers were mean. I remember I had a friend in second grade, and I must have been in first grade, and she was a neighbor, so of course we walked to school, and her class got out later or something, and I had seen other people waiting, because we'd wait for their class to get out to walk home, and I had seen another person knock on the door to ask for somebody. So one day I knocked on the door and asked for her, and I remember the teacher just grabbed me and shook me and told me, don't ever do that, and just shook my shoulders, and I must have looked like a terrified child, Indian child in the hands of a very strict nun, although she was not. But I kind of liked school, and then I ended up in her class, and I really liked reading. And this is interesting to me when I think about it, you know, and my interest in words and stories and things. Even back then, I ended up in her class, and I always thought I was, well, I mean, then I thought, I can read pretty good. I thought I was a good reader, but I could never make it. She would never put me up to the higher reading group. And I think after a while, I was just kind of like, ah, who cares then? Those are just a couple incidents. But generally, I pretty much kind of like school.
Did any teachers inspire you?
Yes, there were a couple of teachers who inspired me. And like I said earlier, I was thinking about that on the way up here. Because when I was in fourth and fifth grade, we had home teachers. And each year, the teacher that I had for a home teacher would move up, so I'd have the same home teacher, and that was Mr. Charles Anderson. And he would ask me sometimes to stay after school because his wife would come, and she was artistic, and we would paint. We'd paint, but they would be like squares for a quilt or something. And when I think back on that, I think that he recognized something in me artistically then. And then the next year I had Mr. Quinn, and he did the same thing. And he was fun. He was fun, and I felt real safe with him. But Mrs. Ruth Rockefeller at the high school really inspired me. And she was the kind of person that wasn't afraid to do something different. And she taught me a lot, and she still is my friend.
How fairly was the history of your people taught, do you believe?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. And especially, I really have a thing about it because of California's history. And, you know, whenever you talk about Indian subjects or Indian situations, it can get very complicated legally and historically. But generally, I really have a thing about California history because I don't think that it was taught fairly at all, and it still isn't. For example, you know, about the gold rush and how great it was. Well, to my people, it was terrible and changed the way life, and about the disease that came before the gold rush, after the gold rush's disease, and how California still has no treaties. But it's also interesting contemporarily because of what's going on with gaming, and now that some of the Indians are pulling themselves out of poverty and have money, and thus how the American system goes, and so in California, have money, so therefore have political clout, and it's starting to bother people. But we could probably talk about that for a whole nother show.
When the subject of Native Americans came up in the class, how do you feel the students, the European students, responded to the subject?
Well, there were certain people who, especially as I got in high school, in my class, who we had an ongoing discussion about such things. Oftentimes, and even still, and it might not be in the classroom, but in certain situations, you know, still people can say things like, why are the Indians crying around? Or I even remember 25 years ago, people saying, you know, to me, why do Indians always have a chip on their shoulder? They're bitter. They need to get over it. I didn't do it. I didn't do, you know, I wasn't involved in the historical atrocities that took place. And my response then was, well, there are reasons why some Native people are angry. And of course, again, that's, you know, a very complicated subject. But even, again, when you talk about California history and the Native people, and for example, in Northern California, the Gold Rush, Central and Northern California, the Gold Rush, you know, when 70% or more of your population in it is, you know, destroyed, is gone, dead, in, you know, a matter of 40 or 50 years, with those people that are gone, go your dancers and your singers and your doctors and your dreamers and your basket weavers. And so to me, we're still, and even my own family history, you know, we're still dealing with that. It's not something that happened way long time ago. It's something that happened to my mom's mother, my mom's father.
Was there a lot of racial tension in the schools?
Not really. And sometimes that can be the subtlety of, you know, when you say racial tension, you know, we're talking about racism. The subtlety of racism sometimes can be just as harmful as, you know, obvious racial tension. And like I was saying earlier, a lot of times it was just something that we knew where it was there. And it's kind of like, you know, the old saying of, you know, people keep in their place. If, you know, the Indians were quiet and didn't speak up, then all was good. But then also, like I was saying earlier about, well, I don't know if all was good, but, it reminds me of a poem that I wrote about living in Willits and being pretty much, you know, a Willits, average Willits family, with a huge exception. but, you know, going to the dime store and using the dime store because it was a big important store in town. And then, of course, being, you know, called Redskin and, you know, being accused of stealing because, of course, that's what the Redskins would do. I'm going to read this poem called America's Dime Store. The dime store of my hometown sold certain candies by the pound. The clerk scooped the jelly beans, chocolate peanut clusters, spice chews, and candy corn into the contoured silver dish countered by silver weights the shape of miniature milk jugs. She then poured the contents into a small, crisp white bag. It was downtown. It was the center of town several blocks from our house. The floor sloped slightly uphill in the back of the store, where you could find toys, kitchen cleaners, and brick-colored plungers. They sold goldfish and sometimes parakeets, depending on the management. They sold fabric, curtains, socks, and cookware, old maid cards, and plastic graveyard ornaments. This is where you came for Halloween masks, Christmas ornaments, and replacement bulbs, Valentine cards, Easter baskets, and miniature American flags for Independence Day. We bought pencils and erasers, ribbons by the yard, and birthday candles. As gifts for our mother, we bought Evening in Paris perfume, plastic flat canisters of talc, and delicate white handkerchiefs pressed into clear plastic boxes. I don't remember many items for 5 or 10 cents, but my sisters and I made many excited trips and stretched our little money on holidays. I can't recall my father ever being in that store. We were Indians in a small town. As the years passed and the store changed hands, a particular clerk came and stayed. She was short, with dyed auburn hair, a round white face, and lips as red as fresh blood. She would be the one to accuse my brother and me and demand we return the imagined pilfered items. She would be the one to call us redskins. We were never banned from that store, but I vowed my absence even before the same round-faced clerk threatened my father from the fence line of her corner property, as he drove backhoe for public works cleaning clogged gutters. Through the rain, she yelled at his efforts and said that she might call his boss, call City Hall, because after all, he was hired to serve the small-town citizens. He challenged her to do so and smiled when he told me this story. Another decade later, my husband bought plastic window shades at the liquidation sale with no sign of that clerk. One more decade, and that brick building is still there, vacant and molding on the main street of this Redskins' hometown.
Do you think Native youth are intimidated or threatened by European youth?
I don't know if threatened or intimidated would be the correct words. And sometimes I wonder if European youth are threatened and intimidated by Native youth. But I know, of course, that there are situations. And, you know, just recently I've been involved with, through my work, with some education endeavors in the Ukiah Valley around the treatment of Indian students or Native students at the schools in Ukiah. And I know that incidents occur, and that there are situations where oftentimes the perception is that Indian students are not treated fairly, and I'm sure, you know, I'm certain that the perception isn't too skewed.
Do you feel Natives have the same opportunities as others do in society?
Sometimes yes, oftentimes no. And if opportunities are there, I think that Indian youth have to work sometimes much harder to achieve because of certain things, you know, I was mentioning earlier. And I think opportunities are there sometimes because of history. Native youth perhaps don't believe that the opportunities are there for them, or that they can take advantage of those opportunities, or they can turn those opportunities into their own dreams.
Do you think gaming or casinos has increased Natives' opportunities?
Yes, I think definitely it has. And one way, significantly, like I was talking about politically earlier, and hopefully that trickles down to youth. But at the same time, I see, you know, youth on reservations around here being able to partake in events and activities that they wouldn't have or weren't able to, you know, before the casinos. And, you know, as with everything, it's a balancing act. I support the casinos and the economic development and the sovereignty of the nations. At the same time, I still see, you know, some Indian people living in poverty and not benefiting from gaming. But yes, to answer your question, I think that yes, the casinos offer and create much more opportunities.
Do you feel a lot of people use the opportunities to their advantage or take advantage of them?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. And I think it goes back to what I mentioned earlier about historically not having opportunities and therefore not believing that the opportunities are there for you and that you can do it. And oftentimes, you know, when we're talking about opportunities, it could mean a lot of different things, but a lot of times opportunities can mean leaving your homeland, leaving what you're familiar with. And sometimes I think that that's hard for Indian people, and it's understandable, although I encourage people to leave their homelands if they can gain knowledge, gain experience, gain lessons in life, because you can always come back, you know, per se. There's that cliche that says you can't come back, or who says that? Something. So sometimes, yes, I think more so there could be taking more advantage of opportunities. But when I always think of that, I always think about, you know, in youth and education and finding a way to take care of yourself as adults.
What are some things you've learned from moving away from your homeland?
Oh, well, I've learned a lot of things, and I've learned that you can, that it's not always the greatest thing to continually be away from your homeland. We always had to, like anybody, we always had to make our journey home, and it was always great. And it still is. I was over there Saturday. We talked till 2 in the morning, visiting, catching up. But like I said, I'm learning a lot from my mother's memory, and I have to really admire my mother's memory, but also Native peoples, because that's how we relayed all our knowledge, was through memory, and it's amazing.
Do you think tribal identity is encouraged?
Yeah, I think it's encouraged, and it's important, because I've always known, you know, that I'm Koyan Kawi. I know who my people are. I know where to go when I need to go, a home. I have a homeland to go to, but I think that it's more than that. It's something inside yourself, and accepting our tribal histories, no matter what they might be. And in my particular case, again, bringing up the gold rush, I am amazed and happy every day to be here, because there were so many efforts put forth to destroy us as people. And I think that you can find a place within yourself in accepting your history and who you are. And part of when I say that, part of a thing is being able to stand and accept or swallow inside yourself the atrocities that did happen. I will still get emotional sometimes when I think about the life that my mother's mother and her father, and that's not that long ago. It was rough. But I'm so happy, because, I don't know, I think about my mother and her brothers, you know, growing up surviving in, you know, some crevice in the deep Sierra and having a very harsh life, but being able to laugh and be happy to be alive and feel blessed with your life.
Do you think life will be better for your children's children?
I hope so. And I hope, when I think like about my niece, I try and make life better for her in terms of having her to be strong. When we were up in the homeland, we give offering, and she was asking me what would be a good thing to say, and I said, ask that we can be as strong as our ancestors were. And I think by giving children knowledge about their ancestors and how strong that they were, and that's why we're here, I think that that's making things better. But I would certainly, you know, want my niece's life to be far, far from the poverty of my mother's life and my own life when I was very young. And so to me, that's making it better, and she works real hard.
Do you think schools gave you more courage and confidence, more so than Europeans?
Good question. Well, you know, I think anytime you learn and gain knowledge that it's good and that it feeds you in a way, it feeds, you know, your spirit and not just your mind. And the confidence thing is a big one for Indian people, because when, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago in Ukiah, downtown Ukiah, there were only certain places where Indian people could go. And so, you know, the parents who had children then, you know, had to somehow explain that to their children. And whichever way they may have done it, it wasn't a pretty thing for children to learn. And so then, you know, how much confidence can they have and thus teach their children, you know, to be confident when you're walking down the streets of downtown Ukiah, you know, have confidence in yourself.
What changes do you think schools need to make that would be more effective and relevant to Native students?
Well, again, it's interesting because, like I said, I've been attending some meetings and things in Ukiah regarding this. And, of course, you know, everybody knows the education system in the entire state of California is not the greatest. I can't remember what we were on in the list, but we're way down there, I know. And it's interesting because, you know, California just recently, it was, you know, hit home again many times about what a big business operation California is, fifth leading business in the world or something like that. And so then why is education so out of skew, if you will? So there's many things that need to be considered when you're talking about reforming education. But again, when educating Indian people, you know, is kind of at the bottom of the list historically. When it comes right down to it, and I think about this when I go to these meetings, and we're all sitting around and we're, you know, using language that we all know, and networking is a buzzword and all this. You know, of course, the thing is to, you know, try and improve student relations, student treatment, Native student treatment at the schools. But to me, it always comes down to, you know, individually as people, when we are faced with a situation that calls upon us to act. And I think that that's the hardest part for some educators, is that it's always so easy to look at the Indian student and think whatever they're going to think in a negative way, instead of challenging, you know, their own perception and their own historical outlook to maybe look at it a different way.
Has the avoidance of Native American history led to many social problems, do you believe?
Certainly, yeah, certainly. And it's kind of, you know, following up on what I was saying earlier and then about, well, what historically you learn in school about Indians. And, you know, so many people in Ukiah don't know what went on in Ukiah 60 years ago, or even, you know, not that long ago. When historical events are ignored, like they often are in the schools, even locally, it's not a good thing. It can't be a good thing, and it doesn't lend to anything positive in humanity.
Do you feel that Native Americans know much about their history?
A lot of times not. And again, I would ask people to examine perhaps why that is. And, you know, when Native children were taken from their homes by force and taken to the Indian schools, where there was one in Covelo, and beaten because they spoke their language, and just for starters. And then imagine, you know, an Indian student trying to have any sort or inkling of ceremony or anything at an Indian school. And so, when Indian children were taken from their homes and forced to go to school, boarding schools, and to become acculturated, assimilated, whatever word you want to know, then they were beaten. They were punished for knowing their history, for wanting to remember their history, because the whole idea was, forget that, come into the white society, be good, and when you get through with school, we will send you to be a servant for a white person in San Francisco, and, you know, you'll have a good place to live, and they'll feed you well. And so how can Indian people know their history when that occurs? Especially, you know, in the times of the gaming money and gaming disbursements, and there becomes such an issue about Indian membership, and if you're an enrolled member in a federally recognized tribe. And I am Koyunkau Indian. My grandfather was full blood. My grandmother was half. My father was half. I am a Koyunkau Indian. My grandfather survived the gold rush. And so, because I'm not a member of any federally recognized tribe, does not make me any less Native than any enrolled member who may happen to be much less in terms of blood quantum. But it's interesting to me because it's too bad that so many Native people view it like that. If you're a member, are you a lineal descendant? Oh, you don't belong to any reservation. Haven't you ever lived on a reservation? It's too bad because Indian people are Indian people, Native people, Native people. And we might ask ourselves, who put the boundaries? Who made these regulations? Why we follow these regulations? And why sometimes we let such things divide us so?
What advice do you have for Native youth in Mendocino County?
One thing I'd like to say to youth in Mendocino County is about the availability of methamphetamine. And I think, you know, you hear a lot about Indians and alcohol, Native people and alcohol. Well, I think methamphetamine is worse than alcohol. And I hope that Indian people can be strong, Indian youth can be strong, and stay away from methamphetamine.
There's a huge epidemic in Ukiah, I've mm-hmm. noticed recently. All my friends that have gone to the high school have gotten involved in that. And it's really yeah. sad thing because they get addicted and yeah. they can't stop and their lives go downhill so bad.
Yeah, and that's it. That's it. What you said, it goes downhill. You might think you're getting high, but you're on your way down.
Do you have any different advice for youth in Mendocino County?
Believe in yourself, and I know that that's hard. Ask people for help, for assistance. Ask people to teach you, whoever that might be. It doesn't have to be an Indian person. It's somebody that you can feel good and feel okay about asking, or somebody you admire. And try and locate your dreams. Try and locate your strengths. What you are good at. What you want to do. And how could that help you to take care of yourself and get you through life? Because it's amazing if you're trying to achieve something, it's amazing how many people will help you along the way. But the thing is that, you know, there has to be some initiation, because somebody is not going to come along and say, hey, I think you're good at this, so why don't you do this, and I'll take you to, you know, get trained in this. But that's a hard thing, too, and it's something that you can't do alone. We all need people to survive. But Native youth can be strong, and I think if you know your history, your even your family history, and realize what our ancestors did so that we could be, to survive, so that we could be here, and that we can have dreams, and that we can make the dreams come true, or we can work toward those dreams. And in working toward those dreams, you can meet people, and that will take you down rivers where you can meet other people, and you can learn, and you can always come home.
Well, thanks, Linda, for sharing your point of view on the show. It's been really fun getting to know you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's nice getting to know you, and now we know each other, and we can say hi on the streets.
Yep.
That was Linda Knoll being interviewed by Sarah Schlauder in 2003. Now we will hear John Trudell being interviewed by Patty Martin in 2006. Patty graduated from Laytonville High School last year and is attending Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. John is an internationally known Native American activist, poet, and musician. The topic is Thinking Clearly in the 21st Century.
So I'm Patty Martin, interviewing John Trudell.
Hello, Patty.
So I have a couple of questions for you, and mainly about youth and how the messages you want to send to the youth. So what is a message you want to send to just the youth in general?
Well, I hadn't thought in terms of anything as a message, right? But what I would say to young people is basically what I would say to anybody, because I think we're, as human beings, we're all equally at risk in this world, just the same as we're all equally entitled to joy, so to speak, right? But because the youth are younger yet and they've got a longer time to be here, right, I think that it would be very important that they understand the value of their intelligence, and that young people understand, you know, to use their intelligence as clearly and coherently as they can, to think before they act, to think about things, to think and recognize as much about the issue that they're dealing with as they possibly can, to see things for what they are, because we've been programmed to emotionally react to situations, and we generally react based, our reactions are generally based upon our beliefs, what we believe this or we believe that, so then something happens and we react to how we believe. And I think that's what's helped to create the mess that the world is in today, is because if you're reacting out of emotionalism and beliefs, then that means you can't have emotional reaction and clear and coherent thought at the same time. One is at the expense of the other. And I think for young people to understand the value of their intelligence, I don't know how coherent I'm being with this, but is what I would say. Understand the value of your intelligence and your own worth. I don't know how to explain it. I just know that we have intelligence, and if we just take it upon ourselves to think, use it to think as clearly and coherently as we can, that to me is the way to access it and develop it. To just understand the value of it. I mean, you know.
So how can youth or all of us obtain clarity of mind after being programmed by this other system and living in this political world in general?
Well, I think one of the basic things to me about clarity of mind, it's got about common sense, what makes sense. See, if something doesn't make sense to you, then don't rationalize and hunt for ways to get it to make sense. If it doesn't make sense, right, it doesn't make sense. Now, there may be things in life that appear that doesn't really make a lot of sense, but if you really think about it, not through your emotions and your beliefs, but think about it, recognize, you know, just think as clearly as you can about things before you do them, right? But in the end, if a thing makes sense, it's worth pursuing. If it doesn't make sense, then don't go there. You know what I mean? Like, especially like in the political environment, it's not just political, economic, religious environment that we're in now, none of it makes sense. Right? To me anyway, I'll speak for me. Right? But none of it really makes any sense to me. So I try to think in ways that do make sense to me and not get lost in trying to make sense out of something that doesn't make sense, because it's a trap. Most of the citizens in this industrial reality are trying to make sense out of things that don't make sense. They're not going with what intuitively, instinctively, you know, a more coherent way to deal with things.
How should youth, like, in order to be, like, making sense, or, like, just to acknowledge and try to determine what's going on in our lives, how should youth sort of face the growing threats, like the military is, like, sort of posing on us, or gangs or drugs or that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, being as you're young and you're starting into this, it's the system itself. The military is a part of the system, all right? The economics are a part of the system. The politics are a part of the system. Whether, you know, and how that breaks down into gangs, drugs, or whatever. And see, there's something about the system itself that doesn't make any sense, all right? And at some point in our lives, we all have to deal with it, all right? And I think, so in a way, it's like, you know, so how to deal with it is, I think first we have to go internally within our own self, within ourselves. And, you know, and understand that you're a human being, and understand the value of being a human being, and understand the value of your intelligence. You know, I think I mentioned this last night about knowing how much power that we have. And it's like, you're young. See, so this shouldn't really apply to you, but I got a feeling that it does. All right? Is how insecure and bad can you make yourself feel? How low can your self-esteem get? See, and at your age, this shouldn't even be an issue. But if it is an issue, then that means something's really, right? But anyway, however bad one can make oneself feel through their fears and their doubts and their insecurities, well, that's power. That's your power, right? We've been programmed to use our power like that and then sit around and believe that we don't have any power. You know, and it's something about straightening something like that. You know, understand your own value. We do have power. We've just been programmed, all right, to perceive ourselves negatively. And what I'm saying, there is no reason for us to perceive ourselves negatively. Whoever programmed that to us, they did it because they're incoherent, right? And they're not clear. And somebody programmed it into them, right? And then, so that's all they know. So they program it to us. And whatever happens to you in your life, it's an experience. Don't judge your life. Experience it. And in the course of that, if there are experiences you have that are not the most positive, right? Well then, if you don't judge it, but you look at it so that you can recognize what happened, you know, you'll learn from it. And you can maybe deflect it from happening again. Because, see, most people, they judge their lives and their experiences, so they don't learn anything from it, and it just keeps happening over and over and over again. But at the very essence, the very heart of it, there's nothing wrong with any of you. No, you know, you didn't do anything. No matter what anybody says, you didn't do anything, all right, other than to be born into a chaotic, incoherent, perceptional reality. And that's all you did, was be born into it. You didn't bring any bad to it. And you haven't contributed any bad to it. But I think most young people, at a very early age, right, get something put into their heads that there's something wrong with them. And there's not anything wrong with you, right? Except we've been programmed to perceive reality in a distorted way, in which we've been programmed to perceive reality in that we're bringing the negative, that there's something wrong with us. Now, you know, just look at yourself, and what I mean about and not judging things, our responsibility as human beings, and we have the ability to go with it because that's what our intelligence brings with us, right, is to recognize the reality of life, not to judge it, to recognize. And to recognize means then we use our mind and our intelligence to look at a thing as many ways as we possibly can. You know, look at it from every way that we can through our thinking process. See, and this will help us to find clear and coherent ways to deal Because the practical realities, all the problems that we're that are in this world that we're confronted with now, there are no solutions. The way that it stands now, there are no solutions. All right? Contradiction now. But there is one solution. And that solution is we can think our way through it, but we have to bring clarity and coherency. See, we can change, we have to create the answers. See, we can create the solutions to what's going on, but depending on how clearly and coherently we think. The previous generation got all lost. See, in my generation, really, there's very little thinking going on in my generation. We're not a generation of thinkers, and we're not, you know, and I just mean that observationally. Our intentions were good, and our motives may have been good, and all that. So let's just say we had all good, good rationalizations and justifications for what we were doing. But we didn't think our way through it. We just behaved the way the generation before had programmed us to behave. You know, so we were against war and for the environment. We were all the right stuff in a way we were trying to represent and find it. But we didn't get there because we didn't know to think with clarity and coherence. All right, because we had the same low self-esteem and we had the same chaos. So we had the same basic distrust of ourselves. You know, so we behaved by the way they programmed us to behave, the way the system, this is the way to do this. This, if you don't like it, do it this way, do it that way. So we fell into that. And we never, so we built our whole thing around how we emotionally believed rather than how we used our feelings to think clearly and coherently. And not that we didn't have any accomplishments, but because we did have accomplishments, but in the end, the way the system works, the accomplishments we had, they were just putting something off. We accomplished putting something off because the system keeps grinding away at the same thing. So we may have delayed something, but we didn't bring any solution. All right? But maybe just through the reality of new generations coming. Right? Well, then maybe a part of that putting off the solution, well, maybe what we did do is we brought this generation here. All right? And if we can communicate to them some understanding about creating reality with the power of their intelligence, see, then maybe this thing can still fall into place for us. Whatever the harshness of the environment is that we're in, whatever it is we've been programmed to perceive reality in a distorted way. You know, I think we should always think of ourselves as human beings first. We should always think of ourselves as human beings. We need to know who we are. See, but because of the way everything has come down, we don't think like human beings. We think like by gender, male or female. We think by class. We think by race. We think by religion. We think by politics. We identify, but we never think of ourselves as human beings. And we can't really connect to the reality of the power of our creative imagination and intelligence effectively if we don't know who we are. We're human beings. Yeah, and to me, it's little things like that, just daily reminding ourselves of these things that help all the rest of us to synchronize. I would suggest that every day you make a communication, prayer, whatever you want to call it, but I'm just saying make a communication with your Creator. Number one, always thanking Creator for life. All right? No matter what's going on, we should be able to thank the Creator for life. All right? And as a part of that, we should thank the Creator for giving us intelligence. Because that's where we have our ability to create the solutions to the problems that exist. See, we've just been maladjusted in such a way that we use our creative energies, our creative abilities, and our creative powers, right? Basically, in a lot of ways, against ourselves. And then what we don't use against ourselves, we use trying to fit in to one of their definitions about how to deal with stuff. See, so we're not taking the time to really just think free, you know. I think everything should be questioned. I would say, and believe. I mean, just put this in your thought consciousness, like, see, that in a way, believe means I don't know. All right? And how many times do you hear that as a part of people's conversation? I believe this. I believe that. Then we're just tricking ourselves. Right? It's better to say, I think this or I think that rather than I believe it. Because if I believe, if I'm going to go into the paradigm of belief, then that means that I'm not thinking. See, my ability to think is limited by what I believe. Right? So that's like putting my thinking in a cage, in a box. Right? So it kind of neutralizes the thinking process. If we conscientiously think or say, I think this, I think that, then we're activating our thinking process. If we go with, I believe this, I believe that, then we're not activating it. See, we're just, that means, well, I don't have to think about it because, right? Because that's what I believe. And I think everything should be questioned. That's how we learn. Whatever the problems are and whatever the state of the world is now, so to speak, right? I think that we can change it. I do think that. Because I do understand, in my own perception of reality, I understand the reality of power. Power isn't how we think. See, that's the reality of power. You know, guns and money and armies and shit like that, those are things that are access to authority, but they're not really power. See, whoever has the most guns or army, they're not going to make them powerful. What this does is this gives them access to authority. Whoever has the most money, see, that doesn't mean they're powerful. All right? They manipulated, lied, they did all the things that do not represent power in order to get to authority. You know, so we make these distinctions, understand it, create our own understanding of the difference between power and authority. See, then we start to get into reality of who we are and what we can do. We can outthink them. I know that we can. It's just a matter of whether we will or not. Is that an answer? Okay.
One of the issues I know that is going on currently with, I mean, I think the whole youth generation is low self-esteem. And I see it in schools. I see it, you know, within myself. I see it with, you know, all that kind of stuff. One of the things it causes it is it causes me to look up to people, to look to, like, my heroes or to leaders or look up to certain people, you know, that, like, seem to have more power or authority over me or something like that. Who should those leaders or heroes be for us, the youth, rather than, like, the supermodels or the magazines that we have right now?
For me personally, but at my age, because I don't know what to say for a younger people, right? Because for my attitude is like, I operate from the premise there are no heroes. There are people who do heroic things, all right? And I think maybe to remember that. Yeah, I mean, this is just from my perception. I'm not trying to... But to me, there are no heroes, but there are people who do heroic things. And some of them may do it repeatedly, right? Or just once it may come up in some way, right? Or some people that go and they struggle through extreme poverty or hard times, but yet they keep their family unit together. Well, they're doing a heroic thing. So in a way, that's a... You know, but these people don't have names that are famous and flashed out there. You know what I mean? So that's why I phrase it like that, about people doing heroic things. So it's hard to say who to look to like that, but I'm going to come back to this other part. What makes sense makes sense. See? If it makes sense, or if they make sense, right, then... consider it. Consider them. Right? Consider what makes sense. And if some, like say someone out here and they're making a lot of sense, and you relate to that, don't make them a hero. This is somebody that makes sense. Let them remain a human being. Don't create any pedestals. Alright? And if they don't make sense, then don't listen. Right? And people may make sense about some things, and not make sense about other things. Well then, don't judge it. Just recognize that. Well, I can trust these people to make sense about this, but I can't trust them to make sense about that. And rather than looking, to me, rather than looking externally, look internal about, I want to do the best that I can do. What's the best that I can do? See, and then you're doing that heroic thing. So you become that. Right? Because, and that's what I would say is, so whoever it is externally that, let's say, you would admire, right? Or put it in that kind of way because of who they are, what they represent and things. Well then, follow as much of that path as you can. Right? Because we have to live it. And this whole thing about the supermodels and all this and that, you know, I know it's a difficult thing to get people that aren't young people to understand, you know? You know, because everybody's got this stuff in them that where they're looking externally for something, right? And we can't, not going to make that go away. But what I do find is rather than try to convince people of anything, all right, rather than try to convince people to go your way, you go your way, all right? And you bring as much coherency and common sense, what makes sense, you bring as much as you can because this will attract like energy. It'll help you find like energy. See, so look for the energy that's compatible to yours. And if there are these energy systems out there that aren't, don't let them engage your energy. Don't try to convert them. You make the sense that you make. You express your realities and your clarities to the best of your ability. Right? And if somebody doesn't get it, don't try to argue them into it. Right? Because in the end, you can't trust them. If you've got to argue somebody into doing something or talk them into doing something with promises and sweet smiles and things, right? That doesn't mean you can trust them if things ever really get hard, because then they're going to say, well, they talked me into it, or they smiled me into it, right, or whatever, right? And then they'll look at us, so, am I making sense? Yeah. Be real to yourself. Always be real to yourself. Whatever you do, don't lie to yourself about what you're doing. And there are many ways we can lie. We can do it through self-justification, self-rationalization, many ways we can bring our denials. But whatever it is that we do in our lives, we should always be real to ourselves. Even if we got to lie to somebody else about what we're doing, right? Always be real to ourselves, because this will help us to find that balance. Because then, when we're being real to ourselves, all right, then that means we're showing respect to that Creator that we're thanking for life, right? It's a way of showing respect. How can we respect our Creator if we can't be real to ourselves? You know, and if there are things in there that we're not comfortable with, right? Accept that that's a part of who we are. You know, accept all our parts and participate in this reality as a whole. And if there are parts in us that we're not real comfortable with, right? But if we're real to ourselves and we can't live with these parts, they'll evolve out of our thought behavior pattern. If they're there, they're uncomfortable, but we can live with it, then live with it. Right? And just be whole. Be whole as a human being. I don't know if that answered your question, but that's the answer you got. Okay, well, I'm glad I did this. All right.
That was an interview with John Trudell, conducted by Patty Martin. Thank you for listening to You Speaks Out, a monthly one-hour program that airs on the last Sunday of each month at 2 p.m. You Speaks Out is produced in cooperation with HALT, Healthy Activities for Laytonville Teens. HALT is a project designed by Laytonville's Healthy Start program. The project is creating many alternative activities for teens in our community. For more information, please contact Healthy Start at 984-8089. Or visit their website at www.laytonville.org/healthystart.html. You Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490, or through the website www.youspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project, get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of a show, and listen to many hours of previous programming and streaming audio. That's www.youthspeaksout.net. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KZYX. They are the views of those who express them. Our next show will be the last Sunday of July, the 27th at 2 p.m. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next month.